From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Today, a podcast crossover event. Recently, I sat on the other side of the mic while journalist Ronan Farrow interviewed me for an episode of his Catch and Kill podcast. We talked about why it was so hard to reveal the allegations about Harvey Weinstein, though Harvey knew that I knew from the first time we met some 20 years ago.
And I thought, all right, like, this is the moment. Like, this is it. I got to do this now or do it never. So I said, I've heard you rape women.
We'll be playing sections from episode 5 of Farrow's Catch and Kill podcast, and I'll throw in a few memories that we didn't cover. But first on the news banter, Peacock emerges from its shell. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So NBC Universal, after running ads of like a little egg about to hatch, they hatched the egg. And from the egg that hatched was Peacock. This is the streaming service that will debut if you are a Comcast TV, an Xfinity TV subscriber in April. It will come out nationally in July 15th. And this is a kind of a choose your flavor thing where you can get what they call Peacock Premium with 15,000 hours of live and on-demand content. That will be free if you are Xfinity or Cox Communications subscriber. But if you are not, you will be able to pay $10 a month to get the ad-free version of that, or $5 a month with ads.
Or if you don't want to pay at all, there is a Peacock free option that has a lot less programming. But what's interesting here is Comcast is really trying to have it both ways. In the streaming wars, you have the Netflixes, the Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus. They are these hardcore subscription-only premium subscription video platforms where you pay a fee and you get your content. There is not an ad-driven option. Here with Comcast, they are trying to keep you within the Comcast cable universe by giving you this Peacock service for free if you're a subscriber, but then they're also trying to join the streaming wars by offering it on its own as a standalone product, and they're also trying to sell an advertising tier where they can have a revenue stream there plus the premium tier, and they believe that if they invest about $2 billion a year in this service, in 5 years, they'll have about 30 to 35 million subscribers across the tiers. And that's a pretty good business for them.
I think that some of the others, like Warner Media right now, stands out with its HBO Max as the most expensive at $15 a month. I mean, Disney's at $7, and Apple is either $5 or free if you're buying a new device. But so it does stand out at Warner Media as the priciest one. I wouldn't be surprised to see them at some point say, okay, well, now we're going to have an ad version that's going to be less expensive. I think some people are critical of NBC Universal and Comcast saying they're coming in to the game kind of late. But I think a lot of people are already really overwhelmed, people out in the world who are not necessarily media obsessed. And the idea of something free, or at least very cheap, but basically, you know, this Peacock free will be 7,500 hours of programming for free. I think a lot of people will be like, yeah, I'll take that. I'll watch a bunch of, you know, Law and Order reruns or something. And that will be something that they might like. Now, if you go for the premium version, because you either are a subscriber or you pay the money, you'll be getting programming that you won't otherwise see. And that includes some stuff that I thought, you know, sounded interesting. There's something from Norman Lear. This is about an old school car wash owner whose long estranged son returns home. And he's very happy about that, except it turns out that the son is now a daughter, played by Laverne Cox. There's another one called Expecting, about a woman who is 39 years old and decides to ask her gay best friend to have a baby with her. And there might be a little more edge to some of these shows.
True, but they've also got some very populist broad stuff like a Punky Brewster sequel series and some of the Dick Wolf stuff. They're developing projects with Amy Poehler. Will Forte is going to bring back his MacGruber character from Saturday Night Live. And one of the interesting things I've noted here is that if you are a Peacock Plus subscriber, you will be able to watch The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. You can watch at 8:35. So, you know, if you're not going to want to stay up late anymore.
I don't know about you, but I haven't wanted to stay up that late for quite a while. And I know with a young child, you probably don't either. So that could be a bonus.
No, I'm not. And, you know, one thing that we're seeing here is the content differentiation and the pricing differentiation. You mentioned HBO. And one of the interesting things about HBO Max is that, yes, it's the most expensive of the services, but it's being built on the back of HBO, which is already the most expensive of the services at about $13, $14. And the HBO Max product is essentially going to be free for HBO subscribers. So here you're seeing Warner is trying to create a Netflix competitor with broad and, you know, massive scale on the back of HBO. And you see Comcast trying to create a massive streaming product on the back of its existing cable subscribers. So every company is approaching this new streaming era in its own unique way based on what it has as assets and based on what it wants for its business and what it doesn't want to sacrifice.
Of course, Netflix is the one that started all of the streaming. And as we know, Matt, they have been super ambitious to break through and win a Best Picture award at the Oscars. We had the nominations a few days ago. There was a bit of a backlash because of the exclusion of women and people of color, which is a separate topic we can touch on in a second. But Netflix had a very rough night at the Golden Globes. Lots of nominations, only two awards. They didn't get the Best Picture awards. They were bitterly disappointed by all accounts. Netflix has multiple nominations in this year's race. The Irishman, in particular, has 10, coming up right behind Joker. Marriage Story has 6. But, you know, we don't know yet whether this is going to be the year, because it just feels like the old guard is kind of asserting itself with this list of nominees. These are kind of a lot of old school type of movies about older white men, basically, in the list of nominees. So I don't know if the old guard of the Academy is asserting itself, whether this is the year that Netflix breaks through.
Yeah, although Netflix does have these films in Marriage Story and The Irishman and The Two Popes that do appeal to that older, whiter male demographic. But, you know, Netflix had a bad night at the Golden Globes, and in normal circumstances, the studio would say, oh, you know, we'll just move on. But when you are Netflix and you're spending tens of millions of dollars and you have 60 publicists who are working full-time on awards, that can't happen in their mind. So, you know, they're really looking at these Oscars in this phase two of when they're, you know, after the nominations, they're trying to win the top prizes. They're looking at how they can be aggressive and how they can do new things to really get these movies to come out on top. And I don't know, this year is so wide open. There's legitimately 5, maybe even 6 movies that could win Best Picture. So it's not, you know, money doesn't buy everything. It's not just that Netflix does a great job campaigning. Now it's really up to the taste of the voters.
Yeah, I mean, we had a wild outcome last year with Green Book, which I don't think very many people were predicting. And some people think that other contenders split the vote and Green Book stepped through. And this feels like the kind of year that that could happen again. I would just feel like there's so much backlash to the list of nominees. It feels a bit, I don't know, it feels somehow that this has been damaging to the brand in a way. The Academy is not a one person or a committee that makes decisions. This is supposed to be a consensus, and they've certainly made efforts to improve representation. But wow, I just feel like somehow it did not work this year.
We'll see when the winners are announced, because the Academy could notice this and come back and give someone like Cynthia Erivo a Best Actress win, because she's the only person of color nominated in those categories. Or it may help Greta Gerwig win Adapted Screenplay, which she is nominated for. And it could help Parasite, which has really been a popular favorite among Academy voters that I've talked to. And it would be a big statement for the Academy to give the Best Picture to an international film.
That didn't happen last year with Roma. It's never happened, but we'll see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In October 2017, the New York Times published the first exposé on Harvey Weinstein, quickly followed by Ronan Farrow's article in The New Yorker. As Ronan recounts in his book, Catch and Kill, he originally undertook his reporting for NBC News. I was in contact with him while he was working on the story, doing whatever I could to guide and encourage him. Of course, I would have liked to break the story myself, but it had stymied me and other reporters for years. Harvey knew that I'd made intermittent efforts to get at the truth, and as I subsequently learned from Ronan's reporting, I was making him nervous. It turns out he had some kind of dossier on me and had sent one of his spies, posing as a reporter, to chat me up. And as you'll hear, that's not all. When Ronan interviewed me for his Catch and Kill podcast, we talked about many things, including why breaking the story was seemingly impossible for so many years. Ronan also interviewed New Yorker journalist Ken Oletta, who had also tried to report the facts without success. Today, we'll bring you parts of my interview from the most recent Catch and Kill podcast episode, and I'll add a few other memories from my years covering Harvey.
This is the Catch and Kill podcast. I'm Ronan Farrow. Harvey Weinstein's criminal trial started a few days ago in New York City. He faces 5 sexual misconduct charges, including 2 counts of predatory sexual assault and first-degree rape. He's pleaded not guilty and has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. Prosecutors in Los Angeles also just announced separate charges, including forcible rape and sexual battery by restraint. The allegations were finally made public in October 2017, but whispers of Weinstein's alleged abuse go back literally for decades. So does the reporting on it. Today, we're going to look at the small but dogged community of journalists who spent years trying to break this open. Like Kim, chasing the story in L.A., and Ken Oletta, who was separately closing in New York.
And he stood up from his chair and he said, "Ken, this was a consensual affair. You're going to ruin my marriage. You're going to destroy my 3 young daughters' lives." And he stood over me, shaking, fist clenched. So when I stood up at that moment, thinking actually we were going to get into a fist fight, he broke down and started to cry. You know, I wondered, was that the bully crying, or was it so fearful that finally he was going to be exposed?
Kim's and Ken's stories taken together represent a decades-long cross-country hunt for the hardest truth in Hollywood to catch what Kim's editor at The Hollywood Reporter once called the white whale.
The 2 names I heard that he had assaulted were Gwyneth Paltrow and Rosanna Arquette.
For much of the 90s, Kim Masters was a reporter on the move. She wrote for trade magazines, The Washington Post, Premier. She covered all sorts of beats, including the Supreme Court.
I had been in Washington. I had covered The Hill. I covered at one point the SEC. I mean, I covered difficult beats, but Hollywood is probably the hardest beat to really get inside.
People trade on their reputations. There's a lot of money at stake. It was hard to get people to talk. It was around 1996 when Kim moved back to L.A. to cover the film industry. And one day in the late 90s, she got a tip about Weinstein.
There was a woman director who had made it her business. She wanted to expose this really passionately.
At the time, Kim was writing about Weinstein and his company, Miramax, a fair amount. This was the era of Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Pulp Fiction. She wrote about how some people felt Miramax had essentially bought the Best Picture Oscar for Shakespeare in Love by spending so much money on advertising. Weinstein was widely considered a powerhouse and still on the rise.
To write about Harvey was to make Harvey mad. And I don't remember what story made him mad, but at that point, his PR guy, Matthew Hiltzik.
Matthew Hiltzik is a publicist with a lot of prominent clients in Hollywood and Washington. He reached out to me in 2017 after Weinstein asked him to suss out what I was up to in my reporting. He was doing similar work in the 90s when he got in touch with Kim.
Matthew Hiltzik set up a lunch. And I hadn't met him face-to-face at all. So I go to the peninsula, and there's Matthew Hiltzik and another publicist. And we're sitting there on the terrace out there at the peninsula chatting, and all of a sudden, Harvey comes running onto this thing, screaming like a madman, "Why do you write this about me? Why do you write this? Why do you say I'm a bully?" Which was funny in the moment.
The irony just right over,
like,
his head.
I don't know why, Harvey. I'm just not. And then he said, "What have you heard about me?"
Kim then faced a choice. Should she confront Weinstein about the rumors?
And I thought, all right, like, this is the moment. Like, this is it. I got to do this now or do it never. So I said, "I've heard you rape women." Matt Hiltzik and the other publicist, I thought, were going to go over backwards in their chairs. I mean, it was a stunning moment.
Kim says Weinstein didn't seem shocked by the claim. In fact, what he said next seemed anything but shocked.
sometimes you have sex with a woman who's not your wife, and afterwards she wants to say it wasn't consensual and you have to write a check. Which sounded like yes, right? I mean, I'm sure there was another part of him thinking, holy I can't believe she just asked me that question.
And what was going through your mind as he said this?
I was just thinking, like, today I am a woman. Like, I just was like, you know, I did the thing. I mean, it would have been very easy not to say that, right? But I felt like I have to. I just have to. It's this journalistic imperative to say, I know this, and I'm going to ask you the question.
Matthew Hiltzik says he remembers Kim confronting Weinstein, but doesn't recall the word rape ever being used.
Matthew Hiltzik may claim that he doesn't remember the word rape, but apparently Harvey does. That became clear when I told the story of that first encounter and the use of the word rape for a 2018 documentary.
He did not seem shocked or outraged. You would expect a normal person to say, I'm sorry, what? How dare you? And there was none of that at all.
Frontline and the BBC, the makers of that documentary, reached out to Harvey for comment, and he responded by email.
In his response to Frontline, Weinstein said that he wasn't shocked because he'd already heard the allegation, and it was false.
Back to the Catch and Kill podcast.
After that off-the-record lunch, Kim felt more sure that the allegations were true. But still, she didn't have anyone on the record. She didn't have enough to publish.
We really wanted to get at it, but it was like trying to grab like smoke, you know, because you're not going to be able to call up Gwyneth Paltrow and say, were you assaulted by Harvey Weinstein, given who Harvey was at that time? You know, this still rising mogul who could basically say, would you like an Oscar or would you like to litigate until I destroy you? It felt like a complete hopeless thing. The New Yorker's Ken Auletta had the same experience.
Journalism has to prove things. We couldn't prove it.
While Ken Auletta and I and some other reporters weren't able to break the story of Harvey's alleged sexual assaults, I continued to cover Hollywood, which meant reporting on Harvey Weinstein, the movie mogul. He was, after all, a huge deal. In 1993, Harvey and his brother Bob had sold their wildly successful independent film company Miramax to Disney. Meanwhile, Harvey grew more and more ambitious and started to make increasingly expensive films, notably Cold Mountain, a costly disappointment for Miramax and Disney in 2003. Here's an excerpt from an interview I did with Harvey for NPR in November of that year. At the time, he was chafing at a change to Oscar campaigning rules and boasted that he might just defy the Motion Picture Academy, even if that meant also defying his then boss, Disney chairman Michael Eisner.
For Miramax, I think we can do what we want. I mean, there's always the case of Michael Eisner firing us, but that might be a cause for celebration. You know, I mean, in all quarters, ours included.
That quote quickly made the rounds, and as it turns out, Disney was getting fed up with Harvey and his brother Bob and got rid of them not even 2 years later. The brothers launched the Weinstein Company, but never matched their earlier success. In fact, they got into financial hard times. We'll pick back up with the Catch and Kill podcast when I tell a story from a few years back when Harvey was promoting what would turn out to be the final Weinstein Company film ever nominated for the Best Picture Oscar. I mean, the last time I saw him face to face was the reception for Lion.
In November 2016, she was at a reception with Weinstein. The film Lion, starring Dev Patel and Nicole Kidman, had just premiered, and it was the Weinstein Company's Oscar contender.
And there was a thing at the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills. It was on like a Sunday afternoon, I decided to go. But I also decided, if I happen to see Harvey, there cannot be small talk, because we were definitely thinking about how can we get at this story. I felt like I cannot stand at a Sunday afternoon reception and chit-chat like everything is fine. So I'm not going to approach him. I'm going to stay on my side of this courtyard. So sure enough, he walks in and he makes a beeline for me. And he just starts right in.
Kim says Weinstein walked up to her and started schmoozing. He talked about his philanthropy, some of his political work.
And I'm just really awkwardly standing there thinking, like, I don't want to engage. Like, I really do not wish to engage. And then, as fate would have it, Nicole Kidman shows up.
At the time, Kidman was getting a lot of Oscar buzz for Lion.
She comes running over. She throws her arms around him. And she's like, Harvey, Harvey. And he says, this is Kim Masters. She's been trying to get me for years. And I said, yes, I still am.
Coming up after a short break, more from Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill podcast. I reminisce about the time Harvey Weinstein threatened to sue me for writing about my father. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, a podcast crossover event. We're listening to sections of Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill podcast about Harvey Weinstein. I was featured on episode 5, titled The Hunt. And I recalled the days when Harvey was riding high. Oh my God, his party at the Beverly Hilton and at Trader Vic's was routinely shut down by the fire marshal.
Welcome back. It was around 2007, and Kim Masters was still occasionally writing about Weinstein. She was also still bumping into him at awards shows and parties, including the Golden Globes party he threw.
Even stars would be standing outside the rope trying to get in. The degree to which he was the king, the glamour around him, it was surreal. I remember going to that party. So I'm just going to tell this story, even though you're never going to use it, but it's funny.
Hey, Kim. We're going to use it.
I took my niece, who was very, very pretty 12-year-old at the time. And this is Harvey, though. It's Harvey working his Harveyness. I walk into the tent of this big A-list party after the Globes. And without a second's hesitation, Harvey walks up to my niece, not talking to me, talking to this very pretty little blonde girl. Would you like to meet Orlando Bloom and Johnny Depp? And she just kind of looks at him like this cobra came out of the basket and nods her head. And they disappear into the crowd before I can. And I yell after him, I'm not doing you any favors for this. This is your thing, bruh.
The way Kim tells it, she was always getting into scrapes with Weinstein over how she wrote about the films he distributed. She wrote about production issues on the set of Gangs of New York. That was a fight.
We had a big tangle over Inglourious Basterds because that is my father's actual... My father was a Viennese Jew who became a British commando. And the actual guys who were Jews and became commandos were very offended by Inglourious Basterds. They were highly trained elite troops. They were not guys with baseball bats.
Inglourious Basterds was released in 2009 at a time when the Weinstein Company, Kim says, was not doing so well and really needed a hit.
I wrote about this for the Daily Beast, my father, the Inglourious Basterd. And so Harvey threatened to sue me. And so he's trying to simultaneously threaten me with a lawsuit for writing about this movie and tell me how much he respects my father's story. Now, the truth is, my father wrote a memoir and Harvey optioned it. I was not involved at all. I made a huge point not to be involved. He never paid my father.
Oh, he was famous for that.
And he said to me once in a meeting when we were talking about, he says, all these people say I don't pay them. Who are these people? Where are these people? And it was all I could do not to say, my father, my 83-year-old father, you son of a b-. But I didn't, because obviously I didn't want the door opened to Harvey then would have said, you know, I'll write you a check right now. And there was nobody's writing me a check.
And still, all the while, Kim was hoping some tip would come through that would break the much bigger story when it came to Weinstein. How many years do you think you circled
long,
this story for?
Long. I mean, intermittently. I don't want to make you think I'm just constantly every week like, let me do a Harvey check-in. You know, every once in a while, I'd be like, oh, this guy just left Miramax. Let's call him. I knew an executive who had been a source who went to work for the Weinsteins and then after a period of time was no longer working for the Weinsteins. So the minute he's out, I call and I say, so what do you know about Harvey and these allegations? And he said, it's true. It's completely true. And I'm like, give me a name. He would tell me there were settlements. There were definitely settlements. And I'm like, with whom? He would always say, I don't know. It really did feel like the ungettable story.
But by 2017, the world had changed and the story finally started to become gettable. Not that it was easy.
By the spring of 2017, I was in the thick of my own Weinstein reporting at NBC News. I was also starting to sense resistance within the network to airing the story. And so I started reaching out to the journalists I'd heard had gone at this the hardest. So what did you think when I called you?
I remembered seeing you on your show, and I thought, is this guy really like a real reporter?
Thanks, Kim.
I wasn't so sure you were going to get there, to be honest, for obvious reasons.
Neither was I.
Nothing to do with you. I remember when you said to me, I'm doing this for NBC. The first time I talked to you, I thought, are you? Because I knew they had done some stuff, like they had interviewed me about Scientology and none of that ever happened. I felt like, these guys don't really have the stomach for this sort of thing.
Kim knew Hollywood, and she wondered if leadership at the network might be conflicted.
The whole weird thing to me of having Noah moonlight is very strange to me. Do you know he wrote Jackie?
Noah Oppenheim is the president of NBC News and a screenwriter. And Jackie is, well, you know Jackie.
And tell General de Gaulle that if he wishes to ride in an armored car or in a tank for that matter, I won't blame him.
Why are you doing this, Mrs. Kennedy?
Oh, I'm just doing my job.
Despite some skepticism, Kim agreed to talk to me. You were incredibly generous right off the bat.
Thank you. I just was
told me the anecdotes you had, the rumors you had heard.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point started calling me unsolicited when you would hear things about how the story was evolving.
Well, and you were like, where do I meet someone by Silver Lake if I don't want anyone to recognize them? Like,
right. I was also, after we started speaking, calling you for just L.A. reporting advice because I hadn't really done a big story that was L.A.-based before.
Yeah, you got to have your little hidey holes. Ronan was closing in, and the New York Times reporters Megan Toohey and Jody Cantor were on the trail as well. Harvey was engaging private detectives to spy on them, and a few months before the story eventually broke, he reached out to me. Here it is. The date is June 29th, 2017, from Harvey Weinstein, big letters on the top.
Out in Hollywood, Kim Masters had gotten an email.
Dear Kim, as you may or may not know, we have a publishing arm of the company, and I have an idea for a fun Michael Korda kind of biography. Are you available to discuss today? All my best, Harvey.
When the note came in, Kim was in the middle of texting with her former editor at The Hollywood Reporter, Janice Min.
So we're chatting about whatever by text, me and Janice Min. And then I say, Harvey W. is calling me. Why did I answer the phone? Kill me. Excuse my language. We're very classy. She says, what did he want? 3 question marks. I say, to offer me a book deal. And she says, I mean, is it a lot of money? Ha ha. Ha ha. I say, obviously, I did not ask. So there you have it, documentary proof. But I did answer the phone. And he said, I wanted to talk to you. And I said, Harvey, we're not doing this. We're not having this conversation. And he's like, but. And I'm like, not going to happen. Goodbye. We're not. No. Of course, NBC eventually killed Ronan's story. In his book and podcast, he lays out exactly how that happened. Ronan ended up publishing the story in The New Yorker in 2017. The rest is history, and as I say on his podcast, the 2 years since have transformed my own life. I've been on the Me Too Times Up beat almost full time.
Having reported on this in previous years and reporting on it now in the present day, how much has changed and how much hasn't in terms of journalism's willingness to go up against powerful interests?
The world absolutely changed in the aftermath of the Harvey story. In terms of my experience breaking stories, the intent to publish is just much more clear. The idea that this is our job. It's been amazing, the night and day difference. Everything changed. Everything changed. Thank you to Ronan Farrow and his producers for letting us play portions of his podcast on our show. Please check out the whole episode as well as other earlier entries in the Catch and Kill podcast. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can find The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.